Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. Really happy to have you along today. Just earlier this week, I was enjoying the gorgeous gardens of London and Southeast England and County Kent with a great group of WPR listeners. There were really some spectacular gardens. But I have to say, the Ellen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus can hold its own with the best of them. And I'm really pleased to have a couple of people from the gardens with me today. Ed Lyon, director of the gardens. He's been with us many times on Garden Talk. Ed, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And another Ed, Ed Glover, is joining us for the first time. He's a dedicated volunteer at the Ellen Gardens. And for over 10 years, he's been managing the Rock Gardens. And Ed Glover, great to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here, Larry.
Really pleased to have them both here. And we'll zero in today on Rock and Alpine Gardens. You know what an Alpine Garden is? Well, you'll learn if you don't know what it is. I'm sure we'll be talking about that and answering any questions that you might have about rock gardens or alpine plants. What to do? What do you like about them? Do you have a spot in your yard? Wonder if a rock garden might work there? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And, of course, we would love to hear from you. And, Ed Glover, what's a rock garden?
Well, there's sometimes been a controversy about what a rock garden really should be. But for those of us who are really into rock gardens, it's a habitat where we can grow plants that grow in alpine and subalpine areas, in mountain ranges all over the world.
Yeah. Is it the same as an alpine garden then, or is it?
Well, the rock garden at Ellen Centennial Gardens is representative of alpine rock gardening.
Okay.
Rock gardening can include anything from simply a garden with rocks, and with much larger plant materials. But traditionally, when we say rock gardening in the horticulture field, we are generally referring to the alpine type rock gardens.
Okay. And actually, a caller from Madison recently visited your gardens, the Ellen Centennial Gardens, and said that it seems like the rock gardens have been expanded. Is that true, and is that a permanent change, Ed Glover?
Well, it's I'm not sure we've really expanded a lot. We have possibly cleaned up a few areas and expanded a couple certain types of gardens. One of the gardens we have there is a crevice garden, and we probably made that more than twice as large this spring as it was in the past.
Okay.
And I also appropriated a little bit of space underneath the gazebo where we're growing some really difficult-to-grow plants, saxifrages and alpine primroses, which come from the European Alps, and they really don't like our hot afternoon sun. Oh. And if you visit the garden over there, you know that our rock garden is really in full sun.
Yeah, it really is. And a crevice garden is?
If you look at the crevice garden over there at Ellen Gardens, you'll see it's we actually built it from flagstones. And we put the flagstones on edge. And they're only about 1 or 2 inches apart from each other. So they form these really narrow crevices.
Mm.
And the rock garden plants will be forced to put their roots down deep along the edge of the rock. And so those roots will be down way, way deep in the soil where it's cool and moist, even when it gets hot on top. And this was a garden which was developed by gardeners in the Czech Republic. So we kind of call it a Czech crevice garden.
Very cool. Why do you enjoy these plants so much, Ed?
Well, I think it started for me probably 30 years ago when I made my first trip to the out west. And my wife and I spent 3 weeks camping and hiking in Yellowstone, Grand Tetons, Glacier. And I was just captivated and fascinated by the alpine plants, you know, that these beautiful plants could survive in those really harsh conditions. And I came back home and I found out there was a group of people that actually tried to grow those plants, the Rock Garden Society. And I went to a meeting, joined, and I've been doing it now for 30 years.
Oh, it's great to have volunteers like this, isn't it, Ed?
Well, absolutely. It's a very specialized form of gardening, and to a certain degree, fairly labor-intensive. So to have volunteers who are focused on some of these more specialized areas is wonderful, because Ed's taken over the management of that garden, something I wouldn't have the same amount of time to do. And I think one of the reasons the caller might have thought that we expanded is in the course of the 10 years that Ed has been there, he has rejuvenated a lot of the areas that maybe got overgrown or refocused the intention of what that area is. So that might make it look expanded, but basically what he's done is cleaned and rejuvenated, and the gardens look spectacular as a result. But the gardens themselves, the rock garden, are not really any larger than they were in the initial master plan. Mm.
Ed Lyon and Ed Glover from the Allen Centennial Gardens today. We're focusing a bit on rock and alpine gardens with them today, and certainly inviting your questions and comments as we move along. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, post a question or a comment there. Interested to hear your experiences, if you have them, with rock gardens, or you may have questions about how to get a rock garden started. Give us a call, shoot us an email, go to my Facebook page. Any of those will work very well. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Ed Lyon, would you say that rock gardens take, you said they took a little bit more, they may take a little more work?
Yes. First off, you're dealing with the alpine nature is a miniaturized version of a plant, grown in another area, different species maybe. So the fact that they're smaller plants to begin with, that takes a little bit more care, especially establishing them, than plopping a great big, gallon Rudbeckia in your perennial border. But also the substrate that you're using in a rock garden, they're extremely well-drained. Rock garden plants won't grow otherwise. So we're using a lot of sand and gravel compared to the same growing media you do in a perennial garden. So watering, you have to be a little bit more careful. In some cases, it might need more. Some it might need less. Also, that's a substrate. Then when weed seeds drop on it, they tend to establish fairly quickly with that nearly ideal situation for putting down roots extremely fast.
Mm. Genevieve in Mineral Point wondered if it makes a difference of the kind of rocks you use. Do the plants actually absorb any nutrients from the rocks, or do the rocks help in some other way?
Well, actually, you can use any kind of rock. Here in southwest Wisconsin, we tend to use mostly limestone because that's the native rock that exists here, and most alpine plants really appreciate that. I mean, they do get some nutrients from the limestone, and it tends to keep the soil slightly alkaline, which most of them like. The other thing that the rocks really do is they provide a source of shade and moisture, because, as I mentioned before, these plants can put their roots, they'll get their roots right down underneath the rocks and stay cool and moist even when it gets hot. But we do have a special type of rock over there at Allen Gardens. We purchased several tons of tufa rock.
Tufa rock,
which actually came from British Columbia. And tufa rock is a calcareous material that is formed when water percolates up through limestone and dissolves it. And then when it redeposits on the soil surface, it forms this tufa rock. Hmm. And it completely surrounds, of course, all the vegetation. And then when the vegetation dies, there are all these little micro fissures in the rock. Hmm. So tufa rock will actually absorb moisture.
Wow.
So the way we use that is we put it about a half to two-thirds of the rock under the soil so that it can absorb the moisture. The rock stays moist, and plants will actually put their roots right into the rock.
Right into the rock. Wow. So that's is that readily available for gardeners?
No, it's not readily available. Actually, the Rock Garden Society, we got together and we put in an order, and we had to buy it almost by the train car load. I think our last order was 44,000 pounds.
Oh, well, they're not going to be dumping that in my backyard.
So, occasionally nurseries may actually, you know, have a supply of that rock.
But, wow.
But to answer the person's question, I mean, whatever rock you have available will work.
All right. And let's talk some more about the plants that typically you'll find. Alpine plants, obviously, are, but talk about the species.
I mean, some of the alpine plants are, as Ed sort of alluded to before, they're sort of miniature cousins of the plants that you see in your gardens every day.
Yeah.
And they're quite common. And then there are others that are, you know, very specialized and not so much. But, for instance, creeping phlox is kind of a backbone of, in the springtime, you see many gardens just covered with masses of pink and white and red. There are creeping baby's breath. Gypsophilas. There are dwarf daisies, Ridgerons, Veronicas, which are common in perennial gardens. We have those in the rock garden. So there's a very wide range of material. And that's one of our goals at Allen Gardens is to have a really wide range of plants. And so we try to have everything from the common things that you can find at the nursery down the street all the way to very specialized things that we have to grow from seed.
Yeah. And Ed Lyon, maybe you can talk a bit more about that. Let's just expand that so people have who haven't been to Allen Gardens know it's really a very cool place. And it's made up of sort of little pages, garden pages that you might call it.
Yeah, sure. We actually have 26 different themed or named gardens within our 2.5 acres, which it's pretty amazing to think we have 26 entirely different types of gardens for people to enjoy. And I think also it might be important to put in context, our rock garden that we call the rock garden is composed of probably 8-10 anyway, different types of rock gardens, different types of growing conditions. So, for instance, the woman who asked about the rock, one area is a tufa bed, very specialized with tufa rock. And another area is a scree or moraine, which represents the melting glacier. We have a sand bed. We have the crevice garden. So when you come to look at Allen Centennial Gardens rock garden, you are going to see within that a wide variety of different ways to do rock gardening, right down to including troughs. So it's not just one type of rock gardening you're going to see when you enter. You're going to see a number of different types, and one type might be more something that you want to do than another type. And so there's everything we do at the gardens, we try to get a variety in there, even within one named garden.
We saw some fabulous rock gardens in England just last week, and they're just some absolutely beautiful, stunning gardens. And I'm wondering, are they becoming more popular? Are they holding their own? They certainly make a nice presentation as part of a garden.
I would say, you know, here in the Midwest, we're sort of holding our own as far as rock gardens go. I haven't seen a huge expansion, but, I mean, for example, you know, the Wisconsin-Illinois Rock Garden Society, which I'm a member of, we have about 100 members, you know, throughout the two states, and that's been a pretty stable number for a number of years now. And the interest in the garden at Allen Centennial Gardens is just quite stunning. I mean, all the visitors we have come through there, we get a lot of really good comments about the rock garden. People are really interested in it. So,
Lorraine from Durand wondered about. She says we know that regular gardens are a good habitat for a variety of insects, butterflies, birds, etc. Do rock gardens host particular kinds of critters?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, certain plants may be more attracted to specific insects, but we see over at Allen Gardens, particularly when the creeping thyme blooms, one year it was just completely covered with red admiral butterflies. I mean, this year the honeybees were just all over the thyme. The birds come, they love our little waterfall. particularly the goldfinches. They're constantly, you know, walking around in the waterfall there. So,
I think any type of plant materials, regardless of, you know, whether it's rock garden or any of our perennial gardens, have their attributes for attracting, you know, all kinds of, whether they're beneficial or not so much. In fact, the voles are very attracted to the rock garden. It's easy digging.
Oh, they are. Oh, easy digging. Oh.
But, you know, I don't know that they're any different. There's certainly a large number of insects and other creatures who, you know, every habitat, every environment has it's following in wildlife as well as the plant materials that are there. Yeah.
The one insect that really likes rock gardens is the golden digger wasp.
Oh.
Which I have not seen them at Allen Gardens yet, but I have them at home, and I know some other rock gardeners who have them, and they love digging in the sand. I mean, they dig little burrows in the sand, and I mean, you could ask Phil Pelletieri, but I'm betting that they, similar to the cicada killers, that they probably kill some critter and take it down into their burrow for their larva to feed on.
We're going to go into our burrow here for just a minute. Remind you all that are talking about gardening and today and zeroing in a bit on rock and alpine gardens with our guests Ed Lyon and Ed Glover. And they are with here on the UW-Madison campus with the Allen Centennial Gardens. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question. Or I'd love to, if you got a rock garden photo, I'd love to see that too on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's where that page is. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking rock and alpine gardens, are zeroing in a bit on them today with our guests from the Allen Centennial Garden, Ed Lyon and Ed Glover. Thanks for listening in. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post there, and we would certainly love to hear from you. Milton in Brook Park, Minnesota, online here. Well, let's go. Why am I having trouble getting him on the air here? There we go. Now I got him. Milton, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm having problems with army worms. How can you get rid of them?
Army worms.
Yeah, we got two rock gardens in the house.
You got two rock gardens, and within the rock gardens, you're breaking up a little bit, so I'm sort of just repeating this. So you have army worms invading the rock gardens. Ed Lyon, have you had that? Or
we haven't had the issue with it.
What kind of plants are they on?
Well, I've got a few apple trees in there, and they're killing my apple trees.
Are these the kind that they form the webs in the branches?
Yes.
Oh, tent caterpillars.
Yeah, tent caterpillars. What I do is I go out and I wait till the worms are all inside the web, the tent, and then I cut that off and put it in a bucket of soap and water to get rid of them. I mean, that's...
It's not going to kill the plants, probably.
No. They'll come back.
They'll come back, but if you want to get rid of them, that's a good way to get rid of them, rather than try to burn them out.
Yeah, they are at least going to be within a certain time period. So if you're taking that nest and eliminating that nest within that time period, and as Ed said, you know, treat them like a Japanese beetle, or such, you'll have, because they're going through a cycle.
Yeah.
So they won't be back. The cycle will be over.
Thanks for calling, Milt. Grace and Madison, on to you now. Hi, Grace.
Hi. I just wanted to know where the Allen Rock Gardens are on the campus.
Well, the gardens themselves, where we are 2.5 acres, the rock gardens are just a part of Allen Centennial Gardens. We are at 620 Babcock Drive. If you go to our website, we have one of the pages on the website is excellent at showing you how to get there. There's an interactive map tell you where you can park.
Okay. And what do I go to on the website? What's the?
It's very easy. It's AllenCentennialGardens.org.
AllenCentennialGardens.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Thank and you'll even see images of all of the different gardens we have. There's one page there that will even go through the various gardens, and you'll see images of the rock garden as well.
And Allen is spelled A-L-L-E-N.
Uh-huh, good. And I assume there's instructions about parking around there, too.
Absolutely. That's the biggest fear Madison folks have. but keep in mind that after hours on weeknights, after about 4:30, and weekends, you can park anywhere you want. There's this.
Oh, they're open.
Okay. We're open from dawn to dusk, 365 days a year.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah. Bye-bye. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And a Facebook question from Martha, who said, after traveling in England one early May, I fell in love with cascading purple displays of Aubriata, is it? Is that close?
Aubriata.
Yes.
Yep.
And they were just stunning. Any hopes of growing it here? What do you think, Ed Glover?
Absolutely. We have it at Allen Centennial Gardens. It comes in several shades of purple. There's a white form. It's a creeping plant, very similar to creeping phlox, and it'll just flow, you know, over the rocks and over the ground. Blooms quite early in the spring. Very easy to grow here.
And stunning.
I think I even prefer the look of it to the creeping phlox. And I think maybe a few less issues, as long as you've got the drainage. You're not going to just pop this again into a very rich, crowded perennial bed. But with the same types of places that creeping phlox does well, Aubriata does well. And personally, I like the look even better. It's a softer look than the sort of sharpish foliage of creeping phlox.
It's also readily available. You'll find it in quite a few, you know, nurseries. So.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you, Karen. And Peter in Rock Island would like to know about good rock gardens to visit in the upper Midwest. We talked about Allen, of course, but what are some other ones?
There's a good question.
Well, we like to think we're the best, of course. In terms of public rock gardens, in the Midwest, Rotary Gardens in Janesville.
That was the first one that came to my mind. Yeah.
They have a small rock garden there. If you go to Minneapolis, there is there's also a small rock garden in the University of Minnesota Arboretum, which is managed by the Minnesota chapter of the Rock Garden Society.
I'm trying to remember if Green Bay Botanical Garden has.
They don't have a specific rock garden.
I don't think they do.
No. No, there are not a lot of them in the Midwest. And again, I think it's partly because of our really hot and humid summers. So it's a little harder. I mean, you have to have some, be careful what you're doing and how you're planting these plants. Because again, even though they may in their natural environment get a lot of sun, they're at upper altitudes where the intensity and the humidity, doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's, I'm wondering now with the kind of weather we've had here, at least the southern half or maybe southern two-thirds almost of Wisconsin where we've got this just tremendous drought. How hard has it been? How hard is it to keep the rock gardens going?
Actually, I think the rock garden looks as good as any garden we have. Obviously, we keep it watered. But those plants are surprisingly more tolerant. Believe it or not, I think they're doing better than our tropicals, which you would expect to love the heat. Definitely better than the annuals and the perennials that we have to, you know, put this cold overhead water on in the heat of the day. I think they've done extremely well.
Yeah, I've actually been very pleased. I was concerned myself that we've had to water a lot. Mm-hmm. But we have a very lean soil mixture over there. As Ed mentioned, it's a lot of sand and gravel. We have one bed that's pure sand. We brought in 10 yards of coarse torpedo sand, and we have dry land plants, cacti and areogonums and all those kind of things. And so far, we're having to put a lot of water on to keep them happy, but they're doing extremely well.
Yeah, so that's a word to the homeowner. So what about just the regular flower gardens? Are you watering the heck out of them?
We are, and almost daily, which goes against what I normally teach people to do. But this is an unusual year, and if you aren't keeping the root systems of these plants moist, they can die very, very quickly in the type of drought and heat stress we have. I think people don't realize that watering, whether you're doing it overhead or hand watering, is different than rain. And plants are still, you can, obviously we're watering daily or almost daily for the survival of our perennials and annuals, but they still heat stress with all that water. And you can put water on and it pulls around their root system, so then they're almost overly wet and then they dry out quickly. It's not the same as getting consistent rains. The gardens look great, but this, it does not matter. This is just not what our plants in the Midwest want. Obviously, water, 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 but you're still going to see issues. One of the things I've noticed, I have a shade garden at home. Hostas and plants of this nature are essentially at a standstill. I'm watering extensively at home. They've got all the water they probably need, but they're still heat stressing regardless of that. And I think a lot of plants are stunting. They're not growing. So there's issues that you get even if you're watering extensively.
Yeah. I've got a lime tree, too, that I think is just not growing, and it's, you know, it's it actually, I've got a flower turned up. I was surprised the heck out of me this morning or yesterday. We looked and there's a flower on it, but I really expected it to be larger than it is.
And well, and especially our vegetable gardeners are going to find issues because a lot of vegetables will not flower, and like your lime tree, unless the evenings go down to a certain coolness. And if it's too hot in the evening, plants like beans and many other vegetables.
Peppers actually, are really sensitive.
Yep, peppers are very sensitive as well. Even though we think of them as a plant that loves heat, they want cooler evenings in order to set flowers. So with the fact that we're not really cooling down a lot at night and going from 190-degree day to the next, we're going to see it affect things like harvest. We have blueberries at the gardens that literally, and I've heard this from blueberry growers, literally shriveled right up on the shrub.
Huh.
You're not going to find many blueberries at the farmer's market this year.
Oh, man. Lucy in Jefferson has a question for you. Hi, Lucy. Thank you for calling.
I'm so glad that I was able to get on. I have some ferns that they have grown beautifully for 2 years. I have, there's some rocks in the middle, and then there's three plants of ferns around them. And they just started to turn all black and were kind of dying from the top down. And it was way before the heat. This happened way back. And they had come up and were absolutely beautiful. And then I looked at them one day and they were getting all black. And they're continuing to die. They're not totally gone, but all of them have black leaves on them now.
Hmm. Do you know what kind of ferns they are?
Well, I don't know the name of them, but they're just your regular old run-of-the-mill ferns.
It sounds still like drought stress to me. Ferns are particularly, in fact, it's the ferns are probably suffering more than anything else now.
Actually, this happened way before the heat.
I'm not talking heat. I'm talking drought, which is a whole different thing. If you have what you're considering the normal run-of-the-mill ferns, though, the most of those regular garden ferns want a lot of compost. They want evenly moist soils at all times, and again, this is another reason they don't like the heat, but they most particularly do not like dry feet. So if they were, if they're stone anywhere around these plants and not a lot of good, rich compost, deep compost for the root systems, I would say that what they're doing is they're drying out. There aren't very many diseases that will take back your ferns that way. And again, starting from the tips back makes me believe the water is being limited, and because it's the farthest reach of that plant, that's not that the water has to travel to. That's one of your first indications that it's a lack of water. Is the tips are dying because that's the farthest reach the water has to go, and then they'll keep dying downward.
What will they be going into a dormancy at?
If this was happening even before the heat, it sounds to me like they've been under stress for some time, because we've had the heat now basically almost since spring. So I'd be concerned that she may lose them all together.
So what do you do in a situation then?
You really need to lift them and get some compost in there. Uh-huh. And, of course, now we're in a very challenging time to be lifting any plants up and out of the ground and putting them back in the ground. But if they're already – if she's lost a good share of them, there may not be much hope anyway. Plants get to a certain point where they're dying back. You're probably better off starting over. Your struggles to try and to keep something like that alive may only result in death anyway.
Mm. Okay, so I should just dig them out and not hope that they'll come back next
well,
year?
Well, again, I'd have to see the plants. If it looks like they still have healthy crowns, if there are some croziers within the crown, then that means that they're still alive, that they'd be putting out new fronds. Most ferns will put out new fronds all through the season. So look down for those croziers or fiddleheads and see if it's doing it. If they're really dry, all the way back, and there's no new fiddleheads, you're probably have pretty well lost them. And you'll know when you dig them up, because if it ends up being sort of a matted, dried up sort of root system, you'll know you didn't have a disease in there, that it was a water issue. Mm. Ferns are, on the whole, and it's not that they necessarily need lots and lots of water. They just need to be kept evenly moist all the time. So a dry out period in between waterings can, if it's a long enough dry out period, can be enough to really harm those roots.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Lucy.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And the other option, go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can join us there. I'd love to see if anybody's got photos of their rock gardens, I'd love to see them for sure. Any seeds which can be scattered on a listener from Edgerton, Karen in Edgerton, any seeds which can be scattered on a steep riverbank filled with large riprap. Our bank is under large oak trees, shady, and is too steep to place planting in, but the grape ivy certainly seems to thrive.
Well, first off, you're going to have to make sure that when you scatter the seeds, they're not all going to simply erode down. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be something that you're doing to that bank to hold the soil in. My recommendation is to contact the folks at Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. That would be Neil DeBall. They do a lot of work with prairie plants, riverbanks. They sell seed mixes. He does some very specific seed mixes for different areas like clay soils. I would think they'd be an excellent resource. You probably wouldn't even have to actually go there. You could give them a call. You could send them an email. Their catalog actually has a lot of good useful information in their website as well. So I would recommend to go to somebody like Prairie Nursery that mm-hmm. does this and does it extensively.
And we'll post the Prairie Nursery a link on the Facebook page too. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can find it there. Marie in Washburn emailed, wondered, I tend to think of the plants in a rock garden as being very low to the ground. Are there taller varieties that will grow well in a rock garden to add some vertical interest?
Yes, there certainly are. I mean, many of the particularly the choice alpines that we like to grow are quite low to the ground, and we call them cushion plants. But you can find taller varieties of columbines, aquilegias, mm-hmm. of course. Dwarf conifers can be added to the rock garden. You just have to be really careful about size, you know, how big your garden is and how large that conifer is eventually going to be. But they will certainly add a little interest. Another plant which Ed knows is one of my favorites is a Daphne.
Mm.
Now, these are not real tall.
Now, what do they look like?
But the rock garden Daphnes that we grow are probably 12 to 16 inches high.
Okay.
The rock garden Daphnes. And the other interest in the garden is that they're evergreen. So they stay green over the winter time. And Daphnes bloom very early in the spring. These plants will be completely covered with very fragrant pink flowers. And if you go to the gardens now, you'll see we have occasional flowers pop out on them even now.
I think they're on their third rebloom, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow. So that's a really cool plant to have if you want some nice smells in your
That's right.
In your garden.
That's right. There are also, Ed knows, another one of my favorite plants is clematis, which some people might find strange since I'm a rock gardener. But there are some herbaceous clematis, which are not, the tall climbing varieties, which can grow in the rock garden. And they will grow some 12 to 20 inches high. So they also fit well and will add a little verticality. There are some campanulas, bellflowers, which get a little bit taller.
One of my favorites that I struggled as a beginner gardener, I thought that I could do in my perennial beds that just don't have the drainage, are the penstemons. And just gorgeous colors, and they'll get anywhere from 10 to 18 inches, beautiful flowers on them, typical to the western United States where they have much better drainage than we do. And they do extremely well in the rock garden. And if she's looking for some colorful flowers and fairly long-lasting blooming perennial, too.
Pestamens.
Mm-hmm.
Pestamens.
Yes.
Oh,
yes. Okay. And also, if you visit the garden at Allen Centennial right now, over in the sand bed, which is on the far west side, we have a plant called Gilia rubra, which is a biennial that is now probably 3 feet tall, has just brilliant orange flowers on it.
Oh, yes.
Tall spikes of flowers, and the hummingbirds love them.
Yeah, that's what those are.
When they're in bloom, everybody asks what it is.
Yeah,
that's from the
beautiful.
American West. That's a native in the American West.
So. Yeah, I've seen them. They're really beautiful, and I didn't get close enough to look to see what their names were. Wonderful. Well, I tell you what, we're having fun today talking with Ed Lyon and Ed Glover from the Allen Centennial Gardens, visiting with them about rock and alpine gardens. We got off into some other flower issues as well. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Talking with Ed Lyon and Ed Glover from the Allen Centennial Garden today on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mealer. Thank you so much for tuning in. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Janice in Frankville, up with a comment or question. Hi, Janice.
Hi. You were talking about tufa rock before.
Yes.
Now, I work for a pet shop that has a lot of fish, and we use tufa rock in the aquariums.
Oh.
So that might possibly be a source if somebody wants to buy some. Perhaps the pet shop would order them just a case of it instead of having to buy it by a train load.
And it is tufa rock?
I do believe so. I mean, it's labeled as tufa rock. I didn't actually ask the owner. He's not here right now. Where it's brought from, but it's the same thing. It's a yellowish color. It's very porous.
Yeah.
And it's labeled as tufa.
I think that'd be an awful expensive way to buy tufa to build a rock garden out of, though.
Well, if somebody wants to do a small one or has more money than I do, I thought perhaps it's an option.
Sure. Or a trough. It would
certainly that's right.
Work
if,
well.
If you only needed a small number of rocks, and if it really is tufa, sometimes people, there's a volcanic rock called volcanic tuff, which some people call tufa, and that's very lightweight. And it's also very porous. I would wonder about using the true tufa rock in an aquarium because it would make the water quite alkaline, I think.
That's what it's used for the fish that like
it
alkaline
is.
Water.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So it probably is the real thing.
Oh, okay. Thanks a lot, Janice, for calling.
You're very
appreciate
welcome.
It. So go to your local pet store if you're interested, maybe, and taking a look and seeing what it looks like and how it's used. And maybe if you're into square foot rock gardening,
maybe the pet stores will start carrying alpine plants.
Marion in Sauk City. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I actually have two questions. One is not really related to rock gardens, but
okay.
I need the answer very badly.
Okay.
Okay, that first one is milorganite safe for vegetable gardening? Because I heard that if you lay it on the soil, it will deter the voles, which I'm having a very bad problem with, eating vegetables. And the second question is about rock gardening plants, the hens and chicks. Is it possible to grow them in the wintertime indoors, at least for a while, through the winter, and then put them out again?
Well, I'll tackle milorganite and let Ed have the hens and chicks.
Okay.
You should have no issues with milorganite. I use it heavily in my own ornamental gardens as a rabbit deterrent.
But not for vegetables. Or for vegetables.
As far as I know, it shouldn't.
Okay.
There was issues early on about heavy metals. But milorganite went and reevaluated and in fact, Paul Tukey from safelawn.org, it's a non-for-profit. He actually toured the milorganite plants, and he promotes it and feels that it
it's
is safe.
Fine. Okay, good. Yeah. That's good to know.
And it's a great deer and rabbit deterrent. I also feel, and this is only my own experience, that it works on slugs with hostas. But they cannot label it as such because in order to do so, it has to be labeled as a pesticide, and they do not want to. Any deterrent also has to be labeled as a pesticide, and they don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And Ed Glover, what was the other question?
The
hens and chicks.
Hens and chicks or sempervivums. They're fantastic rock garden plants, and we have many, many cultivars at Allen Centennial Gardens. They would be difficult to grow inside in the wintertime. They actually like to go dormant. If you had them inside, you would need very intense light, or else they're going to become etiolated. They're going to grow very, very long and tall, and then it would be difficult to reestablish them outside again in the spring. Is there any particular reason why they need to come inside in the wintertime?
No, there isn't, but I grow quite a lot of them, and I've had a couple of questions by people who want to buy them and keep them inside. And I usually tell them I haven't grown them inside, so I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, if they had like a very cool place, a cool porch or something, but inside where it's going to be warm and sort of low-light conditions, they would be very difficult to keep over.
Yeah, I would, if you had them in a container or something, you could bring them in for a dormancy. But that'd be different than actually trying to keep them going and growing.
Yeah. I mean, the best thing is just to leave, even if they have a container, is to, just leave it outside, bury it in the snow or whatever, and they'll be just as happy as can be.
Okay, thanks for the milorganite. I am stopping at McFarland's almost right now to buy some.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Marion, for calling. Appreciate it. And Beverly in Rushford, we turn to you now. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I have a high bluff that I back up to, and I'm semi-sandy, and I would like to know if I can grow on my east and south facing front hills, low growing fragrant sumac in a rock garden?
You certainly can. The conditions are ideal for it. Now, keep in mind, that will not be an alpine plant. Low-growth sumac can easily grow outwards to 8 feet across. So when we're talking rock gardens, we're usually talking plants much more diminutive than that. But it certainly would do just fine for you if you've got the space for it.
Would it hold the soil?
Yes. In fact, that's used extensively for just that purpose, to hold back embankments and things of that nature.
Okay. Are those berries edible or not edible by either birds or humans?
I don't generally see them fruit much around here. I can't tell you offhand. Most of the low-growth sumac I've ever seen has never really put on any fruit.
Okay, so in other words, it's not unsafe if kids go by and...
Well, I would look it up, you know, either through Poison Control Center or look up the plant itself. And these days with Google, you can find that the answer to that pretty easily.
All right. Good. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. And by the way, we have posted up on our Facebook page some photos of the rock gardens at Allen Centennial Gardens, if I'm not mistaken here.
Yeah, it looks like them.
Some beautiful shots there. So go to the Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you'll see some photos from the garden. And speaking of Facebook, we had a question from Roger from Facebook. Says, great show. The reason alpine rock gardens are low is because they are plants that grow above the tree line, right? And if that's so, what conditions happen that makes above the tree line be above the tree line? Ed Glover, what do you think?
Roger is absolutely right. And the conditions that make above the tree line is because of the strong winds, cold temperatures, and so forth, and low fertility. It's mostly sand and gravel up there. And so the trees, you know, larger plants, trees and shrubs just don't survive. And in fact, there are alpine fir trees, which you see sort of right at the tree line, and they're often called Krummholz, which is a German term for flag, because when you look at them, they only have branches on the leeward side of the tree. They can't grow on the windward side.
On the windward side.
So, the conditions are very difficult up there. Almost constant winds and cold temperatures. And that's why the plants are very low. I mean, if you had a tall plant waving in the breeze up there, it would just be...
It'd be done for.
Yeah, it'd be done for. Yeah. So that's why we love those plants. We call them cushion plants, and they just hug the ground, and they have... And the other thing is that about alpine plants is above the tree line, they have a very short time to come out from under the snow, produce flowers, get fertilized, produce seed again. So they tend to produce these big, beautiful flowers to attract any insect that comes by for pollination. So because many times the snow melts the middle of July, and by 1st September it's back again.
Yeah, so they gotta act fast.
Right. So they're big, beautiful flowers, and that's why we like them.
Don in Madison, hello to you.
How are you today?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hearkening back to earlier on in the program, I had a question and I forgot to call in. Speaking of the flagstone that you use to create the garden, roughly how big are the pieces? What percentage do you bury down? What percentage do you bury up? And how far apart are they?
Mm-hmm. Okay, we bury the flagstones almost completely in the ground. And some of them... were probably 2 feet wide.
Okay.
Now, to be honest with you, I don't know exactly how deep you would have to go, but we wanted to make sure that we were not going to have frost heaving. Mm-hmm. So the other thing we did is we used a soil mix that had a lot of sand and gravel, and we only filled the spaces between the stones about halfway with that mix, and then we top that off with pure sand. So the plants are being put in pure sand. Pure sand comes right to the top of the rocks.
Let's see.
And the spaces between the rocks are about between 1 and 2 inches.
That's what I sort of guess.
and if you can get on your computer and look at Larry's Facebook page, we do have a picture of the crevice garden.
Haven't got a computer.
Okay. So the best thing is for you to come by Allen Centennial Gardens and take a look.
I'll try to do that.
And keep in mind what Ed's describing is the crevice garden in particular. There's different ways to plant, set rocks for different forms. One of the things that we haven't mentioned, and we probably should, is the North American Rock Garden Society has a really, really nice publication that you could probably get through their website. And it's called a Rock Garden Handbook for Beginners. It's just a nice little paperback. I think it's relatively inexpensive. Really good line drawings that will describe these various ways to build different types of rock gardens. That if somebody is interested, I think that would be the number one resource that I would send them to.
Mm-hmm. And you can also get that through the Wisconsin-Illinois chapter. We have a supply of those books, which we sell for $5. So
yeah. Good.
Very inexpensive.
Very inexpensive.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you for the information.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. And somebody wondered, what was the name of the tall orange flower that we were talking about earlier from the garden that everybody wants to know the name of?
That's Gilia rubra, G-I-L-I-A.
And they have actually just changed the genus, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember why.
It's Ipomopsis.
There we go. Yes.
They're changing a lot of genera right now, and it's keeping us all struggling to keep up.
Ed Lyon and Ed Glover from the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, talking with Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, and Ed Glover, one of the volunteers. 30 years ago, Ed and his wife got interested in rock gardens, and he's been alpine plants in particular, and he's been doing it ever since and has been for 10 years in charge of the rock gardens at Allen Centennial Gardens. So we've zeroed in on the rock and alpine gardens, but we'll take other gardening questions as well. I know many of you have interests or questions about other plants, and feel free to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And go to my Facebook page, post there at the Larry Mueller Show. We did have an email from Roger. Is there a crucial time to get water to trees that are now wilting, losing leaves, or have leaves that are now brown? Will a tree survive if the leaves have fallen or are drying and falling off today? When will it be too late?
If your leaves are browning up and drying, falling off, you may be getting close to already too late. You should have been watering those trees the whole month that we've been having these hot temperatures. Mm-hmm. The problem is everybody looks at trees, particularly mature trees, as not needing the water when they are watering their annuals and perennials. And obviously over the last 5 weeks, everybody's been just pushing the water to their perennials and annuals. What people don't realize is our mature trees require just as much water. Where in the past we used to tell people that the root system of the trees went really deep into the soil and only went out to the drip line of the tree is absolutely not true. 75% of the root system of your tree is in the top 6 to 12 inches of the soil. And the drip root system of trees, the critical root systems, can go anywhere to 3 to 5 times the width of your tree. So you're talking an enormous amount of your root system only being 6 to 12 inches under. Plus anything that's outside of that drip line, you're probably walking on and you're compacting it. So it's even more difficult for the water to soak in and those growing roots to take up water. And it's always the last thing a homeowner waters. They think, well, it's a mature tree with really deep roots. It does not need water. Those trees have needed water equally and just as much as your perennials and annuals have for the past 5 weeks. So anybody that has not been watering their trees along with the rest of their plants for the last 5 weeks could very well. We're already starting to see leaves color up on trees. They may very well, if we continue this way, drop their leaves. That's their protection from losing any other water. But much like the lawn grasses, they're now telling us that you let go dormant much longer, they will not stay dormant. They will actually die as well. We need to that every single plant out there, even if it's going through some stage of dormancy, still needs a certain amount of water. And I can't emphasize it enough. If you have not been watering those trees, get water on them. And it's going to take a very large amount of water to really soak up those root systems. I tell people, even if you've put a overhead water out there for a couple hours and you think, oh, this has got to be really wet, do something to dig down and see how far it's gone. It takes a long time and a lot of water to soak it up. So there's enough water for those plants.
And it's worth it. I mean, if you got
there's an even bigger investment in that mature tree in your yard than probably the perennials you have. Yeah. But they are the first to be overlooked.
Yeah, and especially trees that were planted maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago, they don't really have mature root systems yet. So they need it even more.
Mm. Larry and Stevens Point, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I know that the university, they used to have a garden right on University Avenue, and in it they grew a bamboo. Now, I don't know if they took it in over the winter, but I don't think they did. I was wondering if there were any hardy true bamboos that could be grown in Wisconsin.
There are. There's probably about 12 different ones that would be hardy. If you go out to Olbert Gardens and then their Thai garden, they have a small, low-growing one there. Now, be careful, because just like with ornamental grasses, bamboo come in both clumping and spreading forms. In fact, the little low-growing variegated form you'll find at Olbert Gardens is totally enclosed in concrete in a little square. Otherwise, it would be quite rampant and take off. So again, I'm sure either Googling on the internet or going to some of the bamboo wholesaler, retailer websites. Song Sparrow Perennial Farm, which is right here in Avalon, Wisconsin. They're a mail order nursery. They carry a couple of the hardy bamboos. But again, I do forewarn you, for the application that you're using, look to see whether you're getting a clumping or a running bamboo as well.
Mm-hmm.
You discourage bamboo forests.
Yes.
Well, it
at again, least here.
It just depends on your application. If that's what you want, then go for it.
You're not going to like it. Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much for calling. Michael in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Michael.
Question. All my sedum ground cover, as the summer goes on, they have these big holes in the center. How can I... what can I do to keep them growing nice and mounded like they look earlier in the season before they blossom?
So are these the really low-growing spreading sedums or taller ones?
Correct. And as summer goes on, they have these big bare spots, like somewhere right in the center, kind of like I think they call it nesting. I've heard that term before.
So they're just they're kind of falling over and so you have a kind of an open center.
Yeah,
it's not a hole being eaten by an insect or something.
No, it's just how they grow as the summer grows on. I wonder if they can be cut anyway that they can be.
Quite get your answer to my question. Are these the low creeping ones?
Correct.
Okay.
With a yellow blossom on them.
Okay. Are they in full sun?
About 6 hours.
That's not a problem I've seen.
It sounds like, I'm wondering if overwatering.
Okay.
Many times if a plant like that gets overwatered, they'll start to die out from the center first.
Yeah, it could be. Most sedums, you know, are very tolerant to drought, so that they'll handle, they won't need to be watered that often.
That would be my first guess, is you're getting too much water in around the crown and they're objecting to that. I'd drop back on the amount of water here.
Do you have a well-drained soil?
Yes. I might be watering too much, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah, give that a try.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling. I got an email from Leroy in Fox Valley. Magnolia trees in the Fox Valley are experiencing an invasion of magnolia scale. What's the best strategy? I know it must be aggressive with these species.
I don't really have any experience with magnolia scale. Yeah. I think maybe I'd get a hold of Phil Pelletieri for that one.
Yeah.
He'd have a lot go through UW Extension and Phil
Pelletieri. Insect Diagnostic Lab. Yeah. It's the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. You go there, you'll be able to probably get an answer from Phil. What we have Derek in Wisconsin Dells. Your turn. Thanks, Derek.
Yes, I have a question regarding what to plant in a very sandy area. My property has mostly gravel and sand, and I have lawn. I've worked on lawn in certain areas. There's one large, very sandy area that I'd like to put some sort of a attractive ground covering in that area. And what would you suggest?
Let's see, a ground cover for a sandy area. How large an area are we talking about?
As my children were growing up younger, they had about a 1,000-square-foot sandbox, the largest in the neighborhood. and so it's pretty large. It's a very large area, and it just hasn't grown in. I'd like to have something grown in that would be attractive, that I wouldn't have to mow and work hard at keeping up.
About thyme?
Yeah, some possibilities would be creeping thyme. I mean, there are a number of different species and cultivars that bloom in white and pink and various shades of red. Also, some of the sedums would do well in that situation also.
Sure.
Thank you very much. And the thyme would tolerate foot traffic as well. They use it a lot around stepper stones. And keep in mind, if you're establishing it in sand that first year, you're going to want to do more watering than you will once it's established, to get it to set roots in sand.
Sure, and that will spread over the entire area?
Yeah, depending on the variety, species, cultivar that you use. And keep in mind, sometimes are very, very low growing, hardly above the ground level at all. Some of them can be upwards to 18 to 24 inches. Go to a good garden center or nursery, an independent, with folks that know what they're talking about, a place like the Flower Factory here in our area. And they can help you find the most appropriate one for your situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They will eventually fill in, but it'll take some time.
Yeah.
Was that meant to be a joke?
No pun intended there.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And you can join in again at 1-800-642-1234. Facebook question from Courtney. He just purchased a hanging Boston fern that was outdoors, put it inside. It quickly lost most of its leaves. I then read that these plants quickly become root bound. I've transplanted it to a larger pot and moved it back outside to give it sunlight. It's still losing its leaves.
Oh, Boston ferns and ficus go hand in hand. Yeah. They don't like disturbances. In fact, I had a ficus tree once. I moved 2 feet, and it dropped all of its leaves on me. And Boston ferns are very much like that. Actually, they do root-bound quickly, but they also handle it very well. They can be root-bound and still be quite healthy, unlike a lot of plants. What it is really deeply resenting the transplanting, the disturbing of the roots, so it's going to drop its foliage on you. What I've done often in cases like that is maybe cut the fern right back. Obviously, you probably want it to look beautiful for the rest of the summer, but if it's going to drop leaves on you, it's trying to reestablish itself. Keep it good and moist. The Boston fern's not much different than other ferns in that they like evenly moist soils, not too wet, not overly dry, and you may be actually cutting it back and letting new fronds come out.
Mm-hmm. Tom in Oxford, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello, yes. I've got 120 maple trees that I've grown from actual seed and then transplanted them all around the house, front yard, and so forth. So it's about 2.5 acres. And some of them, they're like 7, 8, 9 years old. Some of them are taller than the garage now. They're 20 feet, and everything seems to be fine. I've got a couple that I may have lost because they've dropped their leaves and everything. But I noticed two more last night that are, the leaves are starting to turn brown. They're only about 6 feet tall. If I'm going to water these, I'm pretty much going to have to set out a sprinkler, aren't I, and just water the whole, whole sections at a time?
Well, with the number of trees you have, you're going to be setting out more than one sprinkler. And as I mentioned before, keep in mind, overhead watering with sprinkler systems, it's amazing. It's not a lot of water. That's all dispersing into these droplets. You'll also find that there's certain areas, for instance, farther out where it's being thrown, you're going to get less water than closer to the sprinkler. So you have to watch and probably do some overlapping. It's not a consistent watering with many of these overhead sprinklers. And again, I think it would amaze people at how long you have to put these systems out to where you get the enough quantity. You have a really big task ahead of you with that many trees, and there's no easy answer or solution to that. It's just getting as much water as you possibly can to them. Now, in your situation, you may not be able to really get the ground re-soaked up effectively, but any amount of water that you can get on these trees right now is going to help. Certainly not watering them, they're going to continue to deteriorate on you.
Can I do, maybe if I start with those smaller ones that I've got a problem with, are the bigger ones more apt to last? I mean, they must have more root, right?
Yeah, most definitely. The younger the tree, the more water it's going to need. Particularly, and here's a general rule that I learned from a really good nurseryman that specializes in native trees. If you have trees that are less than 3 or 4 years old, it is still advised, even without drought conditions, that you water for every year of caliper you have in that tree. Caliper is how we measure the size of that tree. So let's say you put in a 3-inch caliper tree, even in a normal year, that means you should be watering that tree for 3 years. So your younger trees obviously need more water. I would certainly, if time is a limitation, start with your younger ones first.
Yeah, when I first started growing these, we had dry summers, and I had a 5-gallon bucket with a little hole in the bottom or near the bottom that I would fill up, and it would just slowly seep out right around that tree. And I mean, this was a humongous task. I spent the whole first 2-3 summers just watering trees. But obviously it paid off because they're doing fine. But
yeah, and now your root systems have spread out so much from those trees, you need to evenly.
You need to get it out further.
Yeah, you've got to evenly water throughout where that entire root system is.
All right, I'll see what I can do.
All right, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And I suppose if you had a series of long soaker hoses that you could run out into the tree area and just turn it on and just leave it go for hours.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of soaker hoses myself. Again, the volume of water that comes out of a soaker hose, there's less volume that comes out of the end than the beginning of the hose, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's much wetter right around the hose, and then it dissipates the farther out you get. The only way I find soaker hoses are particularly effective is if you can run them so they're basically about 6 inches apart. I guess one of the biggest issues I have with them is that people put them in, and because they're really that you don't see the watering, you get a false sense of security that somehow these soaker hoses are watering evenly and consistently through that area, and they really aren't. There's a lot of finesse to watering and making sure that the areas are all getting equal amounts, and it's not an easy thing. As I said, with our overhead waters, you have to realize the dispersion of that water varies from the distance of the...
So what's the best way then?
Hand watering is always the best, but again, that involves your ability to spend that kind of time. I still think I prefer overhead watering with an overhead system over soaker hose. Again, if you get a good overhead watering system like the tripod units we use at the gardens, you're going to get a lot more water out faster than you will through a soaker hose. Soaker hoses are probably a little better in the time period when your soils aren't so dried out to begin with. Now you need to be getting a lot of quantity out there as quickly as you can get it to soak in, especially large areas.
We have other folks online here and also at Facebook. We had a Facebook question from Becca who was wondering, is it okay to use something like Miracle-Gro on potted impatiens during this drought? I think I've overwatered and a lot of mine have broken off down at the bottom of the stem, maybe rotted off. I don't know. Would it help or hurt to use Miracle-Gro at this point?
You've got to be careful fertilizing now in these really dry conditions because you could literally burn the plants. The other thing about Miracle-Gro is it's very heavy in nitrogen, which is more for vegetative growth. Now, maybe a little bit at the recommended rates to help the regrowth of the plants that she's having issues with. If she's done enough damage to the root systems and rotting off, her best bet might be to go out and buy some new baskets on sale.
Right. Well, and then I'm looking at the Facebook page and seeing our two Eds, Ed Glover and Ed Lyons are, Judith came in, took a picture of our two Eds, and they're right there. So if you want to see what those two characters look like, just go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Deborah in Brown Deer, hi.
Oh, I'm so jealous that you went to England. I wanted to go so bad.
Well, you come with me the next time.
Okay, and I wondered, did you visit any topiary gardens, and are there any great topiary gardens or any at all in Wisconsin? I have this book. I got it half price book, The Practical Guide to Topiary, and I'm so hooked on it now.
We saw some wonderful topiary in England. I can tell us especially at some of the castles, there were some really beautiful. And I think I have a few photos up. If you go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and look for the garden tour series of photos, there's some topiary there. But what about topiary in Wisconsin?
Not to the same degree that you're talking about, because you're probably talking about some of these great big things that are tiered
huge.
And roosters on top and shaped
bears
and, shaped into bunnies and things of that nature.
Cat and mouse.
That's really not even at Chicago Botanic Garden, you're not going to find it. It's not a Midwest public garden type of thing, and probably mostly because of the intense amount of labor it takes to maintain those. You will have to go pretty much to maybe the East Coast to a garden like Longwood Gardens, maybe some gardens in British Columbia. I can't think offhand. Yeah.
What about St. Louis? Do they have anything there?
Not to the degree that the English do it. I wouldn't think.
I was trying to think. The Missouri Botanical Garden does not have.
No. And their heat isn't very conducive to boxwood and the forms of plants we use, things that we hedge anyway.
Yeah, there was 110 in St. Louis last week. So yeah.
I think probably the one that comes to mind that really truly looks like English topiary is Longwood Gardens. And I know they're even struggling with that because of the enormous amount of time and labor it takes to maintain those.
Yeah. So, Deborah, you're going to have to come with me to England the next time I go.
I'm waiting.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in. And Ed Lyon and Ed Glover, thank you so much. A lot of fun. I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Larry. Enjoyed it.
Appreciate it very much. Ed Lyon is director of the Allen Centennial Garden. Ed Glover had been working for the past 10 years. He's managed the Alpine Garden at the Allen Centennial Gardens. And photos of them up online at my Facebook page, and also some shots of their gardens, the rock gardens, which are really lovely. We have those up on the Facebook page, and I really strongly encourage you to go to their Facebook page, and also, but even better yet, make a trip to Madison. If you're not in Madison, make a trip and take a walk through the Allen Centennial Gardens. You will be very pleasantly surprised. Well, I don't know if you should. It's not a surprise. It's a wonderful garden. You shouldn't be surprised. They're beautiful, and you deserve to see them. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.